Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It is February 8th, 2018, and this is episode 558 of Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, James Jones, and I am joined today by Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Mr. Guillaume Bayette.
Happy to be here.
It is day, I'm going to make up a day and say it's day 16 of the You're Done Blackout.
Oh, God.
Which, to be fair, I think I just did it better than the voice actors in the game. So, well, I just wanted to put it out there while I'm working on my White House. I can't remember what the term is for it now. The petition to get.
Should voice actors strike again? You're ready to cross the picket lines?
Yeah, that's what I thought was going on. He's auditioning for the
problem
spin-off.
for that is that it was done in Europe, so that it didn't matter. But you know what? No, I would play an Ardanian soldier spinoff where they just all just scream "You're done!" at each other constantly.
Like that's imagine if it was like a Xenoblade Warriors game and the enemies were exclusively Ardanian in nature.
Well, because there aren't that many other human enemies in the game, so they would have to be. So it'd just be running around screaming, hundreds of people screaming about whether or not you should forget them, how done you are, or my personal favorite where they just scream, "See here," which makes no sense in context, but that one didn't get removed because I don't know. But God, now I want an Ardanian Musou game. I want to see it. Somebody make that. Somebody go make a video of that. It'll be good. Trust. It'll be definitely worth the effort to make that parody. I promise. But, we'll call it day 21 of the hunger strike. Not that I'm going hungry or anything.
So what, you started the hunger strike 5 days in advance, like sort of anticipating the,
I sensed a darkness descending, and I decided that I needed to act ahead of time, and unfortunately Nintendo got to it first. But their crimes will not go unpunished, he says, with over $150 of video game pre-orders for Nintendo consoles coming in the next 6 to 8 days. It's fine. But hi. We record a podcast. You know, normally there's four of us, but John is out today doing something. And so as a consequence of that, we had to move back our WiiWare Retroactive to next week, or at least part one of it. If you have not been playing along, you still have time to cut the hair of a bunch of fucking plants and shake your Wii remote to produce babies so you can throw them at cubes. I don't know. Yumi and the Cubes and Bonsai Barber are both weird games. Published by Nintendo, that use only the Wii Remote. You'll want to get started on Bonsai Barber pretty soon, because that game is basically a daily game. You can only play it for a handful of people, and then you're done. Or you're done, if you want to be specific.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
But I'm through day four, so I just cut a... I just had a celery that I cut their hair yesterday, so they could go to London on vacation, and then they sent me a postcard about going to see Big Ben, and then they came into my shop the same day as I got the postcard, told me they hated London, and asked me to cut a bell into their hair. A celery? Said unequivocally, "I hate London and I will never go back."
Is this the spiritual successor to Princess Tomorrow?
This is the spiritual successor to whatever acid trip these former Rare employees were on.
I guess there's some animosity in Twycross for the capital.
I guess
what's going on there. It's vegetables pissing you off. So it seems like a worthy success.
That game has actually gotten me pretty upset. Guess what? The Wii Remote shakes a lot. But we'll talk about that next week. And there's a lot to talk about for such a small package. But, new business. I don't have any. John might have some, but he's not here, so nobody cares. But Greg and Guillaume have new business. In fact, Guillaume has a game that I talked about last year that I really like. So, Guillaume, why don't you go ahead and kick us off?
Yeah, sure. So finally, I had been waiting for Night in the Woods for a long time. It's one of those titles that came out when we knew that the Switch was going to be a thing. And I kind of... There's a number of small indie games that I've talked about on this podcast that I ended up playing on PC because I had already bought them long before they were even, you know, a twinkle in... who would be in charge of this? Reggie's eye, I guess.
It'd be a Wada at that point, but I don't want to. I really don't. The twinkle in the eye thing here is not.
No, it doesn't work. Anyway,
I don't think they were looking longingly at the Wii U, going like,
let's hope to get some of that Steam action.
They weren't looking at a pile of cardboard that was Wii U boxes either, going like,
we can do something with this. Okay, well, fine. Anyway,
because I don't want to have to name the episode Reggie's Getting Randy, okay? That's the problem here.
Just don't, then.
Well, now I have to. It's fate.
So, actually played Night in the Woods on Switch. Been waiting for a long time for it. And as such, like, the game came out originally with, like, to really great reviews. And really, like, I kept seeing it pop on my Twitter feed, and, like, it seemed to really strike a chord with people. So expectations were high, and I don't know if that is why, you know, I'm a little bit let down by some aspects of it.
Can I ask how far you're in?
I'm several hours in. There's no easy way for me to check that information, but I've started part three, and I'm hoping at this point that it's there's not too much before part four or before the end.
Yeah, I'm struggling to think of where that would be.
It's a little bit after. Part three starts after Halloween.
Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. So, yeah. Things have started to move.
Yeah. And the fact is I played a lot of hours before I got to that point that, as you say, things started to move. So... my problem, I guess, with the game is that it's a little bit slow. But first things first, Night in the Woods is a 2D kind of, you know, platforming game where mostly the focus is on the story. You're playing as May, this anthropomorphic cat who has gone back home in her quiet little town of Possum Springs, going back home after kind of flunking out of college. And She's only been there away for a few months, but already, like, she goes back to her friends, her parents, and there's kind of, there's some tension sometimes that you can feel. Like, everyone seems to be happy to see her, but also you get hints that, she was kind of a screw up in the past and might have made a mess of things. There's talk of an incident, at softball where she might have beaten another kid.
There's no might of. She crushed his face with a baseball bat.
Yeah. And, you know, like, your friends are happy to see you, but there's also the fact that you went to college and kind of failed, you know, to do some of the growing up that they've had to do, because now they've, you know, they've started, you know, small jobs and they have rent to pay, and they've had to mature in ways that May obviously hasn't yet. And you kind of get the feeling that she's been a little bit protected from some you know, harsh realities. In fact, like, as you play through the game, you learn more and more of what's happening, and you kind of come to learn just how protected from the truth, and also how self-centered May has been.
Straits are really dire in Possum Springs.
Yeah. But still, like, in the meantime, like, you're trying to make the most out of it, and you just, you know, hang out with your friends and swing a baseball bat at fluorescent tubes that your best friend is throwing at you, you know, kind of like a scene from 40-Year-Old Virgin. Various other activities where you make crime happen, you steal pretzels, all sorts of fun stuff. But most of the game, really, like, you're just kind of jumping around, making your way across the map. The town of Possum Springs is maybe, like, most days is like three screens wide, but also several screens high, because you can usually make your way up to the rooftops with platforming. And the flow of the game really is just like you get up in the morning, you go, you start exploring, you go check out what your friends are doing, what's in store for the day, and then you choose which friend you're going to spend time with in the evening, and then you get back to bed. And in between kind of the activity with one of your friends, like you can also explore a little bit the town and find various things. Like, yeah, you can feed this family of rats that you've adopted for some reason, the stolen pretzels, as I mentioned. You can like listen to your neighbor's, poetry. You can, I don't know, like you can go find, like discover, obscure constellations on the rooftop of one of your neighbors. It doesn't sound too exciting, but it really manages to flesh out like this little town and like the various characters, and it's neat.
It's very surrealist.
Yeah, it's also very surrealist.
Like Selmers, he mentions, who writes poetry, is terrible at it.
She's funny.
Her poems are awful, but May indulges her largely. And they're kind of funny because of they're really like they're just random. Like I think she writes one about how spooky her basement is or something.
Sure.
Like that. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, that's, and then May goes, that's deep, and she's like, nah, it's just the basement.
Yeah.
it's like oh, okay, well, okay.
Yeah, the writing really, you know, makes me smile. Like, it's maybe not laugh out loud funny, but it's well written. Like, and you can, I think that you mentioned when you talked about the game that it kind of sounds like internet joke writing, except
a bit.
Yeah, but it feels a little bit more polished than that. I think that it's good writing. It's fun. It's fun to talk to these characters. The thing that I'm less enthused about is the platforming and the fact that you kind of have to trek all over the place to see what on that day you can interact with. You know, like the town is like a few screens high. You can go into inside the it's not a subway station, but it's underground. Like there's some sort of canal there. And, so not only you have to kind of visit all the rooftops, but you also have to go underground and check out, like, well, can I talk to the granny who's there, who tells me very, very little at a time about my granddad, but, like, you know, I want to learn about May's granddad, so I'm going to keep checking that underground canal and hope to see that granny. But like every day, like you kind of make the rounds of the town, and that mm-hmm. takes a while. And I guess that I could just not care and miss stuff, but I'm kind of invested. I don't want to.
That world is really what the game is about.
Yeah.
And occasionally, I found a whole area of town on like the second to last day. I just never found it.
It might have not been open at that point. But
it was a platform I just didn't know I could jump on. Like, I never tried it because I always thought, well, that's not the platform. And then I tried it and I'm like, oh, there's all kinds of stuff up here. And
right.
I like a whole mini quest spawned and I had to run that all in one day. But like, it's it's nuts. Like this town, how much stuff is just hidden in it.
Yeah, it has layers, figuratively and literally. I guess that, like, it's weird. Like, I've had the same complaint, although that was a while ago now. I don't think listeners remember, but games like Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon, asks you to revisit the same levels over and over again, and it hides various things. In various places, but you can get, like, you can find new things depending on which mission you selected for that level. You know, it's kind of the same deal with like Super Mario Sunshine's blue coins. You know, like you kind of have to comb over everything every time that you revisit a place because a little thing might have changed. So that's kind of how Possum Springs feels right now, and it's getting a little bit tedious to me. But I, other than that, like, I'm really enjoying it, and it's kind of neat that the you know, instead of blue coins, what I'm finding for going through the the ordeal of combing everything every time is little story bits, you know, a little bit more backstory, maybe, you know, a fun mini game. And yeah, like, I'm enjoying the game a lot. I guess that the one thing I'll say about the Switch version is that it runs really well. Like, there's, as far as I know, like, it's 1080p when the Switch is docked. There's no frame rate hiccups. It actually, sometimes, you know, it uses the HD rumble to good effect. I think when trying to find consolations, for instance, you do get kind of visual clue when you're getting close to one, but you also get the rumble, which can tell you if you need to check up, like, go up, down, left, or right. So that's kind of neat. The one downside of the Switch version is that perhaps the loading times are a little bit longer than on more powerful hardware, and that can add up because, you know, you get loading times when you exit maze room, when you exit the house, when you go one screen left, when you go another screen left, when you go inside, like, the video club, the, you know, the grocery store or wherever, like, and it adds up because, as I said, you're going to be going to these places each and every day, in-game day, and it adds up. So yeah, that might contribute also to my feeling a little bit, not burnt out, but yeah, it's a little bit tedious.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, to expand on what Guillaume was talking about, having to go and do your rounds every day, there are characters with whom there is essentially just quest threads. And I mean, they're not quests in as such. They're just like, they have things they give you and you have to go visit them to advance them. And like Lori, who's a mouse, who's a high schooler, who I don't guess kind of takes a shine to May, even though May is a complete train wreck. If you want to get all of Lori's stuff, you got to go visit her every day and talk to her. And it's really good. So you want to.
But she likes to sit on a rooftop.
Right. But you have to get up to that roof, and that takes some effort.
Yeah.
But she tells you about the horror movie she wants to make, which sound awful, but May, being weirdly optimistic about them, just, you know, oh yeah, that sounds great. You have people like Germ Warfare, who Germ Warfare is the greatest. Germ Warfare is the best name for a character in any video game ever.
I don't think I've met this person.
Oh, you have to meet Germ Warfare. He's out by the I can't remember what they call the Walmart equivalent.
Oh boy. Donkey food, no.
The food donkey. The food donkey. Yes, the closed food donkey, which is the name for their grocery store in town that closed. Germ Warfare is a bird. And he thinks he's more dangerous than he is, I think is probably the best way to describe him. He shows up in a lot of the stories with the party, but you can also just have, like, you know how every day you pick one of your two friends to go hang out with, or one of your three friends?
Right.
Usually, on a lot of days, you can just do that same thing with Germ before you go do them. And Germ will take you off somewhere and do things that are best described as crimes, but largely are more Germ thinks they're crimes, and he's just weird. He's a very strange character.
Yeah.
But everybody else reacts to him, whereas he reacts to no one. I think it's probably the best way to describe Germ.
So that's a whole thread in the game that I missed. It kind of reminds me of a Persona game in a lot of ways, where you have to kind of advance, what are they called again? The link?
The social links.
Social links, yeah. So there's a little bit of that. Like, you kind of choose which person you're going to hang out with, and that uses up one time unit. And, you know, like, that's kind of the resource that you have to look out for, I guess.
Yeah. To give you, but only for May's trio of friends. Everybody else, like, you can spend as much time as you want before you go advance the story for that day. Just to give you a little bit of desire to go run down Germ. she asks Jerm where he lives, and the game says he's, quote, from somewhere, and his answer is that he lives in a tree. Which, it makes sense, he's a bird, except no one lives in trees in this game. And nobody's quite sure if he's joking or not.
Yeah, no, it's a neat game. I still haven't finished it. And, you know, like, you're experiencing the story that they want to tell. Like, you don't really have much say on what happens. Like, there's a whole party early on where May's getting pastored, and you just can't help it, even though you can see, you know, where it's going. And you're just like, can I just sit this one out? Can I just have May not drink so much that she's going to make a fool of herself? But you can't help it, you know, no. Like, otherwise the game won't advance. So, you know, it's not so the game, it's a story that has interactivity to it, but it's not a choose your own adventure kind of deal. You know, you're very much experiencing the story that they want you to experience.
Yeah, even things where that you haven't gotten to yet, where it feels like they're giving you a choice, it's still the illusion of choice. Like, because no matter what you pick, you know, the same outcome happens. It's just the interstitial dialogue to get you there is different.
Right.
So the main story beat still happens.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm enjoying it. The game has tons of style. And as I said, it's well written. And I'm just going through it with Karen, and we're really both enjoying it. I'm kind of looking forward to the end now. I want to see the conclusion.
Weirdly, actually, this game has an update coming out. I don't know if it came out yet or not.
It does. The Switch version has the two DLC packs.
The Weird Autumn expansion.
Right. Yeah, which I think I've read in passing that someone say that, oh, it doesn't really tie with the main story as much as I wanted to. I'm going to do that after I'm done with the game. But it is included in the Switch version. You're getting everything.
Okay. Yeah, I might have to. I'm not sure if I want to go procure Weird Autumn or not, but it's a neat. I mean, as you said, you're here for the writing.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about my?
Sure. I mean, we've got time.
Yeah. So very quickly, my Nintendo Gemo prediction, a cardboard rowing machine, did not come out of nowhere. I had Wii Fit on my mind because I've actually been using Wii Fit U recently because my back was hurting. I hurt my back, and a couple of weeks of painkillers did not really help. So I thought, oh, what the hell? Like, maybe I'll try to do some of the yoga exercises. And it's funny because I never really did much of I didn't use the activities, the routines of Wii Fit U as much as I could have. You know, I would log in my number of steps and not really bother with the exercises. So I guess I never really noticed just how improved Wii Fit U is over Wii Fit, but it really is. Like, I'm gonna miss that. Like, if we don't get, and we probably won't get, a Wii Fit for Switch, like, I don't know. I'm really gonna miss it.
I mean, they will call it Wii Fit, certainly.
Yeah, probably not. But also, like, it won't have the Switch doesn't have a camera on it, and it's a feature I've really enjoyed, because what I can do is I don't, you know, I'm living the dream scenario that Miyamoto envisioned with the Wii U. Like, I'm not turning on my TV. I just put the Wii gamepad on the Wii U gamepad on the pedestal thing in front of me on the table. I'm standing on the balance board, and I can follow along with a trainer on the gamepad screen. But also, you know, you can activate the camera on it, and it just shows you, like a mirror, it shows you doing the exercises. And so that's pretty useful when you don't have, like, a giant mirror in your living room or anywhere really in this apartment. And so, like, it's a feature I really appreciate. And so I've been going at it for about 2 weeks. I've been using the routine feature. Like, I built my own kind of set training regimen. Like, I strung together a series of yoga poses to try and do something about my back. And after just a little bit over a week, like, actually the back pain subsided. So Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. I think I'm going to keep using it, which is kind of unfortunate because the Wii U kind of, it kind of sucks having to use it nowadays. it takes forever to load up, and I really enjoy this particular piece of software, but otherwise, like, I think I could put away the Wii U and kind of forget about it at this point. And looks like I'm not going to do that. But God damn it, I need to do some yoga. I need to prove wrong the physiotherapist I saw a couple of years ago who basically told me I was the least flexible person he's ever seen.
Nice.
Yeah. And I don't know why I didn't take it seriously back then, but I'm getting older and creakier, and God damn it, I'm going to do something about it now.
Did you get up in their face and yell, "I'm number one"?
I probably couldn't. I was probably... It was probably too painful.
I would be up in your face, but I can't get up, so.
Yeah.
Can you come here so I can yell in your face, please?
Exactly.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
I never actually used the trainer bit. I mostly just used We Fit You, which is still a terrible pun. I mean, just atrociously bad. I just basically use as a fitness tracker. How do you feel about the actual exercises it's having you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, they're pretty good, but right now I just mostly focus on the yoga stuff. So I'm doing my sun salutations and, downward facing dog poses, and, it's been helping. For the thing is, like, there's still quite a bit of, downtime between the two exercises. Like, the trainer must tell you, "Oh, good job." And I don't know. Like, I could take it or leave it. Eventually, when I... Well, that's the thing. Like, the camera feature right now is helpful enough that I don't feel like I could do the same yoga poses without the We Fit You on, you know? I feel like I would lose something. I would lose some precious feedback. Mm. But eventually, when I'm, I guess, comfortable enough with that routine, yeah, maybe I can just put the Wii U in the closet. Finally.
Poor Wii U.
Mm.
Oh, well.
I liked it at the time, but it's time to move on.
Mm, for the end of the plastic crap era, the start of the cardboard crap era?
Exactly, yes.
Your cardboard balance board is going to have some difficulty functioning, I'm afraid.
Dull, corrugated future, here I come. I don't know. Please move on.
I'll try. Greg?
Yes?
What have you been up to?
Well, lots more Celeste, more than I would have thought, actually, but we'll get into that in a little bit. I've spent a couple of hours playing the Radiant Historia Perfect Chronology, the new... subtitle, I think, for this remake demo that was put out. So,
Demo.
Yes, yes. Huh. Well, in Europe anyway.
Yeah, there's a Europe demo. We don't have one, I don't think.
I don't know. I guess it is somewhat more incumbent because on them to put a demo out here, because as I was about to mention, the DS game did not come here.
Right.
Of course, DS games were region free. Whereas 3DS games are not, but it didn't come out here, and I didn't get around to it really. I mean, I was editing the show at the time, and both Johnny and James played it and spoke about it quite a lot. And
I send a copy to then?
It wasn't me.
Oh man! For whatever reason, I was sure it was you. Because I definitely sent a copy of that to the UK. I don't know who I sent it to now.
Well, unless it just you never mentioned it. It was, I don't want
to. Greg Leary.
To be fair, I routed all the stuff I sent you through Carly. She could just kept it. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I've not played the game before in anything, but I heard a fair bit about it, and I heard what was said about it many times editing, as Guillaume knows.
God.
Some of these things can get burned in your head more than you care to realise, but, more than, almost like a decade later or whatever, I think it's like 7 years, is that right? 2011? Yep. It was quite a late DS game, but not like crazy late. But you know, it's faded a little bit, but I remember the praise and all that kind of thing. And it was something that I always kind of liked the idea of getting on DS because you know, it was I imported plenty of games back then. But, you know, I didn't get around to, now you've got this remake. So I thought, let's try the demo. And I've been reading the reviews and stuff. And, you know, I get, it's funny, you know, at the end of this you know, cycle that now you get remakes that completely ignore 3D. Whereas, like, that was the reason to remake it at the beginning of the system's life.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kind of makes sense. But aesthetically, it's kind of interesting because it's doing kind of something that you might expect from a DS-era RPG in that it's kind of reminiscent of the PS1 kind of era of, like, your polygonal environments, but you've got a sprite characters running around them. This is also something that, you know, the 3DS Mario & Luigi games do, but they do have the stereoscopic effect, which kind of is nice in a lot of ways, but it also kind of embellishes the fact that they're flat sprites walking around this 3D environment, and so it kind of makes it seem like Paper Mario, but kind of half-assed because they don't do the paper aesthetic. With this, it's more, it might not be like gorgeous or anything, but it was a little more cohesive than I was perhaps expecting it to look. The way that the polygonal environments kind of try and mimic a kind of, you know, from the sort of the way they're textured and stuff, try and mimic the aesthetic that sprites have and kind of blend them together as best they can. I think it works pretty well. I see it certainly seems kind of retro, but not unappealing.
Yeah,
visually.
They pulled the same stunt in the original game, and I'm comparing them, and they did a better job blending the textures, but they also changed the color palette pretty significantly in the remake, so it looks like it might be easier to pull off.
Oh, certainly you'd expect. That's the biggest thing and the biggest problem you had doing this kind of aesthetic on DS, or, you know, the PS1 kind of era of consoles, is texturing wasn't really that great yet. So, you know, so it was kind of difficulty to get that kind of blend of these different kind of visual elements. Whereas your 3DS obviously can, you know, especially kind of without having to worry about stereoscopic stuff, you know, can handle, you know, much better visuals, presumably. Although, like I said, having not played the original, I can't make those comparisons. But, you know, it doesn't seem like it's been hugely ambitious in terms of overhauling, you know, how the previous one looked. It seems like it's kind of more of a tune-up or a polishing than a complete overhaul. But like I said, I quite like the way it looks.
Yeah, it's just so weird that this is being remade, because I think it's the game that I was playing when I upgraded from a DSi to a 3DS. So I could have...
Now you got to do it again.
yeah, I don't think so. And I don't think I'm going to play it again unless... That's the thing. Like, I think I kind of eventually got tired of it. And I put it aside. And once I wanted to go back to it, I couldn't figure out exactly what the game wanted from me, where I was supposed to go. Like, I had all these nodes in time, that I could go visit, but I couldn't figure out exactly what I was supposed to be doing. But apparently this remake does make it easier to just, like, if you just want to experience the story, if you want, you can kind of get rid of all the combat when you revisit eras, places that you've already been to. And so that seems like a pretty smart way to kind of let people just experience the story and not have to deal with kind of a wall of enemies every time.
I think you still have to initiate with the advantage, which you could do by hitting the enemy on the battlefield before the fight started. And I think it just auto-resolves the battle with you winning it and gives you the relevant experience.
Kind of like when you do kill enemies automatically in Earthbound, I guess,
yeah,
at that point.
Right.
But if you don't initiate with advantage, you still have to fight them. And the battles in this, in fact, I wrote the review for NWR, the original game, was like some of the run-of-the-mill enemies felt harder than the boss fights. Because you would get like, oh, here's six enemies and they're all behind walls. Have fun. It's like, oh, shit. and then that would just be this long slog.
Right, because the game's combat is very much like you have to take into account the position. Yeah, you have to line up your attacks to... I don't remember the details, but it was like position and kind of combo oriented as well, I think.
I mean, in the demo, you've only been introduced so far. I mean, I played it for a couple of hours and it hasn't finished yet, to be fair.
Oh, that's quite a hefty demo.
A lot of it is narrative, because this is actually, as far as I could tell, the beginning of the game, as opposed to what you've seen with some like Bravely Second, the demo that was of that, where it was kind of this alternate kind of chapter that wasn't in the game. So I think that kind of helped them, introduce you to things that are in the game without it having kind of the weight of introducing you to all the narrative elements and stuff. So it could kind of give you a flavor of the gameplay and the story and the world and all these things, but without having to do the heavy lift that there's usually going to be with RPGs set in a whole other world with its own sort of institutions and rules and all these sorts of things. So in this case, with this demo, because it is the beginning of the actual game, there's a great deal of that, establishing these kingdoms and they're at war and who you are and all this kind of stuff, which generally the plot and the writing seems to be somewhat more interesting than the I sort of typically associate with a game of this type. I did have a sort of amusing moment when he was introduced to the protagonist Doc, who was referred to as a sort of an intelligence agent, a spy, who has a trademark red cloak.
Yes.
it's kind of like just going around everywhere calling yourself James Bond, isn't it? I mean, it's
like, to be fair, it works for him.
Yeah, it's not really the sort of thing intelligence agents should be known for. So there's a lot of that. That's what's taken up a lot of the 2 hours to this point. But the battle system, there has been some of that being introduced, and the fact that you can have like skills that can kind of maneuver your enemies into a different position on the sort of the grid that they have for position wise, and then that allows you to kind of hit two enemies at once if you use one attack to move them onto the same position as one of their sort of comrades, and then your party members come in and attack that place where you're moving the other enemy to. You can kind of get two for the price of one. That's, I assume, is the very very much basic kind of element in play with this battle system. So it seems interesting so far, the battle system. The question of whether it would become fatiguing over time and the length of the game, especially as this has been embellished further in terms of there is further narrative content now. And it does give you the choice of, like, I guess if you are familiar with the game, it suggests that you play in a mode wherein the kind of new narrative elements are interspersed with the rest of the game, whereas if you're not familiar, it suggests that you go with a mode where what it describes as append mode, where all the additional stuff kind of comes afterwards. So I guess for people who've already seen the main story, it's a way to kind of freshen it up sooner, because you're getting some of that stuff you haven't seen before sprinkled in. Whereas they feel, for people who've experienced it for the first time, it's still best to kind of get the core narrative done before you get to the extra stuff. So all kind of interesting. Like I said, and of course the Shimomura music is all, I mean, you hear it for a few seconds, who did it, even though obviously I know who did it from back in the original game, but it's very recognisably Shimomura. That's a big plus. So this is something that I am quite interested in, even though I haven't necessarily been using 3DS a great deal at the moment. I'd be quite happy to have it there, to chip away at. It's the kind of thing that probably take a lot longer for me to work my way through, now that I'm not using the 3DS so much. But, 3DS is different from Switch. It is more portable. It's a lot easier to kind of just stuff in your pocket and, kind of maybe I'll use it, maybe I won't kind of thing. rather than Switch, and I'd be happy to have something that seems this high quality to go to, you know, over however long period of time it would take me to work my way through it. And I would have the option of expediting matters with this friendly mode that you discussed, if right. I so desired.
Yeah, and I gotta think that if it's like every other demo of an Atlus RPG, that's just the beginning of that RPG. Probably your save transfers.
Probably. So just as a aside, because you mentioned the music in this game, which is phenomenal. Have we done this game for an end theme?
Not to my recollection. We do.
I
have
feel like it's something I would have asked for.
Yeah, it's you know, I've thought about it over the years, because it's shocking how long is we've been over 3 years now that we've been doing music every episode. But my knowledge, my recollection of the master list is not absolute, but I would have to say no.
I am looking at the list right now, and I do not see it.
Yeah, so, you know, James may well come up with something that he likes a lot from it, but if there's any listeners out here who've got big favorite from
it. Oh, no,
from
we did. We did. Episode 515, we used the piano selections.
But is that actually from the game, though?
The song is.
The song is, but the arrangement, that's what I was thinking. I don't think we've used something from the straight out of the game soundtrack. Okay. It's kind of like we did that with Xenoblade too, right?
We did.
Well, Xenoblade as well, I should say. Yeah.
We did both, because we used the Snowy Valak Mountains theme as well in Xenoblade and a piano remix.
So, you know, we've had. I'm not sure if the fidelity has changed at all with the 3DS version, again, because I can't, you know, make the direct comparison, but it sounds really nice coming straight out of the game at this stage rather than just arranged or anything. Definitely something that I'm interested in. I'm also interested in Strange Journey as well. That's in May. Deep Strange Journey.
Deep Strange Journey.
Yeah, which is the same sort of thing in terms of it was, you know, a DS game that did not come here. I still could have imported it, but I didn't. But everything I've heard about that suggests that it could be, you know, an interesting entry point for me personally to the Shin Megami Tensei kind of sphere of things.
So I can answer a real quick question if they it looks like they redid the music.
Oh, they did. Right. So it's higher fidelity, mostly, kind of thing.
At the very least, I just popped open a song and it's recorded, and the other one I don't remember being recorded.
I see. Well, yeah. So that could be an idea. I know you have purchased this game, James, already.
Yeah,
so.
I've bought this game. I don't know if I'm going to get it. But
it's kind of academic in your case, but it could be an additional. Inducement for some people that did enjoy playing it the first time.
You know, I figure I got this game as a reviewer. I got this game for free the first time it came out. I don't feel bad buying it again because I'm not buying it again. But I remember distinctly staying up until 4 a.m. on a Sunday. So going to work it was Monday at that point. Because I felt like I was at the end. And I'd already written a review, so it was completely academic at this point. the embargo hadn't hit yet, so I could have changed it, but like I'd already written the review. It had been edited. It was ready to go. And I remember distinctly getting to the credit sequence, which was long. This game has a very long credit sequence. Like, very long.
As you could imagine for some of these RPGs.
But it was also very nice because it was very well made. I just remember sitting there in the recliner in my parents' house because I was at home at this point because it was so long ago. This was 2011. And just watching those credits roll forever and going like, these are really beautiful. This song's amazing. I want to go to bed. But like that game... I remember the last 2 hours of that game with remarkable fidelity, given how long ago it was. And maybe 20 minutes of that was the credits, but I am really eager to go back to a game that made its ending. Obviously, the ending of a game can stick because it's of itself is of value, but that one stuck because of the game as a whole. And so I'm pretty eager to go back and drill into that, even if the new character they've added, I looked at and thought, oh no, it's going to be one of these, isn't it? But
it's always dangerous to bet on when an RPG is going to end, I find.
This one, it was a situation of A, the final boss was tough, and I may have been underleveled, and B, yeah, the game had more for me. But it's cool. This is a cool game. I'm excited. I'm excited to play it again. I'm excited you get to play it for the first time.
Yeah, like I said, I'm not sure, you know, if it'll be like, I've certainly got no shortage of things to play through and stuff, so I don't know when and you know, even if and when I get it, it could be a very piecemeal kind of thing, but I'm glad that it's getting a sort of even if it is a bit kind of late, arguably, on the 3DS, although it was late on DS2.
Yep.
But you know, to get a shot at the European market this time.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, like I said, I don't have any business stuff this week. I've been preparing for our retroactive and playing Fishing Resort because I made a mistake. And now I've promised the stream that I'll play Fishing Resort till we get to the Arctic because my fish tank is empty for the Arctic. And so we have to fix that. But that's going to do it for new business this week. When we come back, we're going to have some listener mail. I know it's been a little bit since we've really dug into the inbox and we've been ponderously going through our emails, but we're going to try without that chatterbox John Lindemann to move through these emails quickly.
Yes, it's all his fault.
Stay tuned. Back. It is email time. I wasn't going to say we're back with listener mail, but I say that so much, here's a variant. It's almost like I did something with meaning. If you have an email that you want to send us, you can send it to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We will answer questions or field comments. If you want to tell me how bad a job I'm doing, that's another way you can do it. It's one of many. I find new ones that like bricks through my window. That's a good one. That was a fun one. So if you want to send us a question, do it like that. As a reminder, again, we'll be doing our retroactive next week. And we're still looking for WiiWare games to retroactive on. So send us any games you think we might be able to have a 20 or so minute conversation about that will be lost forever. But for right now, we're going to do emails. And Guillaume, why don't you read the first one?
Sure. Brian writes, I once heard a film critic say the best kind of remake you can do is of a bad film with a good concept. In that vein, what bad games would you like to see get remade, rebooted, or even vastly improved, a vastly improved sequel? On paper, a 3D Donkey Kong Country is a great idea. Donkey Kong 64 itself has its moments, but is ultimately poor in execution. The thing, the danger, I think, with this email is that there are so many games that, you know, could be improved. Sure.
Yeah, I think there's a line here of just like, could this game be better? Yes, but this is more of a like, this game has a good concept, but is fundamentally not fun. Like, it's crossing a boundary of just like, the game has some flaws to like, the game is flawed.
Well, in the rare... vein, I don't know, like the Diddy Kong Racing is an excellent game, but it suffers from being a rare game on the N64 and has, you know, a terrible frame rate that, I don't know, makes it extremely hard to play nowadays, in my opinion. Right. So is that what we're looking for?
Maybe. Or? It may be.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's one of the differences with the sort of with games and films, isn't it? In terms of, you know, I think there's lots of games that are not nearly what you would call bad games that would indeed benefit from being remade and have done, you know, because remakes have been awfully popular in sort of recent console cycles and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I feel like to some extent, maybe the best kind of remake of a game is not so much a bad game, but just something that might have been good in the first place, but had certain limitations that you can undo essentially these days, because it might be technical, it might be even just like design sensibilities, like maybe it was hamstrung by kind of vestigial arcade elements, you know, because that was just the way games were back then, that you could redesign, you know, and make them more fun today. So I think, you know, in terms of, for me, I'd be struggling to come up with something that I consider to be an outright bad game that would, you know, be like my ideal remake. But, you know, it's not a particularly original answer, but it is something that I feel strongly about in this sort of category is Zelda 2, in terms of, you know, it's a game that... is a bit awkward in terms of, you know, when you look at it now, in terms of it's kind of caught between sort of, you know, what would become established kind of genre, you know, templates and all this. You know, it's got RPG elements, but it's also got, you know, the, as I've sort of already mentioned in the generic sense, these kind of vestigial, like arcade kind of elements that don't really sit well with that and all this kind of stuff. So I think that could benefit greatly from being remade and or in some fashion, and to be honest, I mean, so many Zelda games have been at this point that it kind of is almost a surprise that they haven't got around to that one. But perhaps it's just because of its you know, relative you know, it's probably one of the Zelda games that has the least affection held for it, I suppose, or is thought to anyway in the general perception.
Well, the more I think about it, the more I like my Diddy Kong Racing idea, just because I can't really quite get into it because of the frame rate now, but I mean, the game is certainly an interesting concept. Like, a lot of people, I think, agree that the single player had more meat to it than most Mario Kart games. You had, like, kind of a adventure mode where you had missions to accomplish. You had boss battles. Like, you had, there was a lot of inventiveness. I guess the closest thing we have to a spiritual successor to that would be Sonic. And now, what did that? What
Sonic
is that title?
Sega All-Stars Racing.
Exactly.
Oh man.
Transform.
Yeah,
All-Stars Racing.
Thank
transformed.
You. Yes. Okay. So yeah, I guess that would be the closest, because that did have kind of a lot of variety in the missions and
The vehicle changing
as far as the progression. Yeah, and
kind of thing.
That's true. The vehicles changing, but also kind of the various goals, the objectives that you had in any given mission. Those were quite varied, although they're repeated. But
sure. No, which in our quest to be ruthlessly topical, there's a lot of talk about Sumo doing another one of those, even though Sega have denied it.
Yeah, and then marketing or brand partners who make toys and stuff said, oh yeah, one's coming out. So Sega needs to learn to write better NDAs, basically. You know, the Dreamcast was littered with these all kinds of like weird concepts that just don't quite work as a game, for one reason or another. You have things like Seaman, which conceptually is fucking lunacy in the best way, but just doesn't quite work. Or I would argue that even like the Jet Set games, they're neat concepts, but they don't play particularly well. But because they were more willing on that system to just throw stuff up against the wall and see what sticks. I would say that in outside of that system, but not in Nintendo space, games like Deadly Premonition, which certainly tell a story that's weird, and like it's full of characters that, dare I say, are Lynchian. I wonder why, because it's just a massive ripoff. But like that game is just completely shattered and broken to the point where like cars will just flip over mysteriously for no reason because the physics engine doesn't work right. Or the game will have you, or has sequences of driving that go for like 7 minutes for no reason, but because the map needs to be look like a dog once the game finally pans out enough for you to see the overhead map, that it's actually a picture of a dog. So that means you have to drive through the tail, which means that's a really long drive. Just cause. But if you want to get into Nintendo space, you know, you've got stuff like Doshin, which never came out in here, but I've played it. And like, Doshin's got some neat ideas. It's kind of fun. But like, there's a lot of stuff in that game that's just not right. Like, it just doesn't feel good to control. The actual mechanic of like, your real only method of influence is where you put trees, when trees die if you don't put them right. So you have to arrange trees in a circle to make more trees. Like, that kind of stuff's just not particularly fun. But the concept, like, we know it works because we have, I mean, it's basically Populous in some ways. Mixed with Black and White. But, which are both, you know, they're both Lionhead games. But there's something about, like, that mechanic that works and that world that works. That idea of, like, you have this big lumbering giant who's trying to influence the world around him. Just doesn't play well. And then stuff I touched more recently, I think the Gravity Rush games have amazing concept. And the idea is awesome. But I think they play terribly. And I think how they structure the game missions, basically they're just generic-ass open world missions for the most part. Just completely under-deliver for that game world. That world is amazing. But it just, I mean, it utterly fails. The gameplay utterly fails that game, that series, which is a bummer.
No, it's not a bad game, but it sure was hampered by the technology of the time. Kirby, Tilt, and Tumble. It's just so ripe for a remake or a sequel, and I don't understand why that hasn't happened yet. Of course, the original game had the accelerometers in the cartridge and could detect, you know, you tilting the Game Boy around, and so that would make, that's how you made the Kirby move. Unfortunately, it came out at a time when the Game Boy needed basically like the brightest light bulbs you could find to be able to see the screen, and so that kind of got in the way of the gameplay.
That one didn't come out in Europe either, did it? Because of the chemicals?
The chemicals?
Yeah, the WarioWare Twisted thing was definitely heavy metals, I believe, but I'm not sure about Kirby.
Okay.
Huh. So, like, today's Nintendo devices all have, basically, gyros in them. There's no reason why we don't have this game yet, so I don't get it. But yeah, it could definitely be improved and made today.
It did not come out in Europe.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what in the JRPG space would fall in here. And there's a couple that pop into mind. The first, although it got remade, and it's probably not fair because this game's actually still really good.
What if Lufia 2 was an action RPG that was also really bad?
that I could throw off the stage during a PAX event? Yeah. and then have Chris Kohler ask for it because it was the last Lufia game he didn't own, including that weird Game Boy Color one that came out, Gaiden.
Yeah, that's the virtual console, Gaiden.
Wow.
Yeah,
but
that's
not Lufia 2, though.
No,
sadly. Not Lufia 2, which is a masterpiece. Lufia 1, real hard to go back to. The first Valkyria Chronicles got remade, but it's so broken. Like, the actual game itself is just so utterly broken that, like, being remade in such a way that it rewarded strategy better versus just rewarding finishing the game fast would make it more of a strategy game. But the one that jumped into my mind in the JRPG space was Infinite Space, which is a game I talked about on this show, that has a million mechanics. That game has more mechanics than I can even name. To the point where there is a whole paragraph of mechanics just cut out of the review because I believe John was the editor, and John's like, look, I get it. I get it. This game's got a lot of mechanics. You can
too
stop.
Granular. Yeah.
No, I wasn't. I was giving them high level. That's the scary part.
Oh, wow. I guess it would feel too granular for the
reader.
Yeah,
but then you get in there and you're like, oh, no, all of this is super important.
The grains are so much smaller than I thought.
Yeah, the problem is that a lot of those mechanics are either too heavy, or they don't work, or they're random. Like the I complain about it in the review, the base invasions where your fleet cuts through an enemy fleet, which was usually hard, defeats an enemy ship, which are like a boss ship, and then invades a base. And then you have to dispatch an army into the base who fights their way down into the final room, and then you play rock, paper, scissors. I mean, quite literally, it's rock, paper, scissors.
Oh, so it's that's also a spiritual successor to Princess Tamala.
There you go, yeah. but the problem is that if you fail rock, paper, scissors, which is inherently a random exercise, you lose. And then you have to redo that shit, which is infuriating. Because it's totally random. Like, there's no like, oh, you can pick up on this theme here and you can figure this out. It's just random. There's a few things in this game that could have been dramatically improved with some refinement and made that game from being like a frustrating but enjoyable game to being like a legitimate classic on the DS.
Yeah, and a lot of the time with games, and this was far more prevalent, in the early days when the technical kind of limitations were the thing that were most likely going to kind of limit this. But game, you feel like the most sort of apt candidates are games that were ambitious, too ambitious, yeah, arguably, for the platforms they were on or for the development resources they had, whatever it might be.
Or just for like game design theory at that point.
Yeah, they hadn't kind of caught up to... where everybody kind of had a good sense of how certain sort of dynamics should work or something, again, I don't think that, again, maybe it's true in some cases, but a lot of the time these games that were over ambitious probably aren't what I would call outright bad. Like, so, I mean, no. I could the Zelda 2 example somewhat falls into that, and that is probably I think that was certainly an ambitious game, and that's a lot of what happened in the 8-bit era, those second games that like Simon's Quest is another one that and again, the need for something like Simon's Quest to be remade or something that's been kind of mitigated by the fact that eventually Castlevania came back to the sort of exploratory side of things with the Metroid imitating sort of branch of the series, but Simon's Quest is still structurally different from that and would also benefit from some real kind of as a rigorous remake, because for me in that case you could say it was a little bit ambitious for the time, going around this sort of Transylvania world and finding levels that are hidden within it and talking to NPCs and kind of RPG stuff and all. But the thing is, ultimately the actual levels that were nested within the world, the mansions, just weren't good. It wasn't just the ambition that was the problem. I mean, that was the stuff they already knew how to do, and they didn't do it well. So, that fits a little bit more into what Brian's talking about, I kind of feel like, in terms of that game certainly was conceptually stronger than the execution was, even in the areas that were, kind of more within their grasp.
I would say a good example of what you're talking about here, a game that's too ambitious to the point where A, there's a technology limitation on them, and B, they don't know how to execute on their ambition, is something like Shenmue. And I know that game has its defenders, but like every experience I've had with that game is just bafflingly dull. But they built this outrageously over-designed world for a Dreamcast era game. Like, and they're trying to tell this epic story that's really just too much for what they're doing, and Ryo's voice actor sounds like he's been taking Quaaludes, and the game itself is slow and ponderous because it's a mystery, and they're trying to tell the mystery in excruciating detail and reveal it to you, and like the whole real-time world thing, not real-time, but like everything has days and time ticks off, and the clockwork mechanics... They tried to do so much more than, say, even Majora's Mask was doing relatively contemporaneously, where there's just 3 days that are being planned out. This entire world of Shenmue has a calendar and over a long period of time, and everybody has a role they play all the time in that world. They just didn't know what to do with it. Weirdly, Sega goes back to the well on this when they finally get around to Yakuza, and it's not nearly as much of a clockwork game, but there's a lot of mechanical stuff that's kind of similar. And in that case, they said, well, let's dial that down. Let's dial back to trying to build a clockwork world where everybody has a role to be, and we've scripted out every person's behavior, but still managed to make a world that in many ways feels more real than the Shenmue one, even though you're going to see NPCs who say the same thing every time, simply because it actually feels like human beings are living in it and not soulless automatons. And you're actually playing a game that's fun to play versus doing QuickTime events. I guess Star Fox for Wii U is the other candidate if we want to go Nintendo.
I would say, though, you know, on the subject of ambitious titles and whatnot, I mean, it is possible for things to, you know, be bad because they're too ambitious, you know, as well. So, you know, ambition is not always like a good thing in itself. But
oh, totally.
You know, with games being such a young medium, a lot of the time we can say, well, there's a reason why it was too ambitious back then that doesn't have to be true now.
I think
therefore the remake could come around and you could, you know, realize those ambitions quite plausibly today. Whereas, you know, in some cases, perhaps more recent cases, you know, conceptually it still might be problematic in terms of, you know, having a focus is generally, you know, quite an appealing thing to me in a game, and not being too sprawling. I don't think every game that's ever been too ambitious is ripe for a remake, because in some cases I think you could go back and say, nah, it's still too much. You know, even with today's tech, or you threw a huge budget at it or whatever, it still could be problematic.
Well, and sometimes your ambition is misplaced. I mean, you can
I'll
give you a great example. Duke Nukem Forever, which is made fun of all the time. One of the problems that caused that game to code to a million E3s was every time the dev leads saw something in a game that they thought was cool, they wanted to do better than it. So they would see tech from like Quake, that they didn't have, and they would go like, oh, well, we need to put that in our game now. Well, our engine doesn't support that. Well, I guess we have to remake our engine. And like, it wasn't like a gameplay design ambition. It wasn't like we have this idea we want to execute. It was just like, no, we have to be the biggest and the best there's ever been. And it's like, I mean, that is a form of ambition, but that's not an ambition that warrants a remake. That's just
idiotic. It's very specific to that time and place as well, isn't it?
I guess because there's a million ways to be ambitious.
Oh yeah, exactly. So, I brought up the point about those being, you know, quite well suited, those sorts of games, but it's not universally true. And I say that generally, I'm thinking more of you know, games in the, you know, the sort of 8-bit and probably, you know, the 32-64-bit eras mostly. You know, games that were really, especially kind of, you know, you think of that early 3D stuff. You know, there's a lot of cases where people didn't know exactly, you know, they wanted to do something big and, you know, kind of groundbreaking, like this is what you can do with 3D now, but they didn't exactly know how to do it. And, you know, it seems to be a pretty good candidate, you know, those sorts of games in a number of cases, but...
Sunshine,
you know, is an interesting case. The DK64 example we had in the email.
Yeah.
I
don't think DK64 is that ambitious. I feel like it's just a growth off of what they had already been doing, and they just didn't realize why people.
I think it could benefit from a remake in one really obvious way, which is to just get rid of the character switching at barrels.
Oh,
instantaneous character switching would make the game far better.
Thinking it would be get rid of the colored bananas.
Well, you know, I mean, that's another component of it, because really that's what happens is like, oh, well, you know, I come to this part of the world, I see there's a color that this character can't collect, so now I've got to go and find a barrel to change character.
And then figure out how to get that character up
there. And, you know, hypothetically, that wouldn't have to be a terrible design decision if it was kind of like, well, you know, the modes of traversal or the abilities that these characters have are sort of substantively different, and it's, you know, one thing to kind of go there with the one character, but then the other character has to do it in a different way that might be more challenging or just different, and then, you know, they get the coloured collectibles as kind of a, you know, it's just a signifier. But right. But a lot of the time it is really just, no, you just walk there and you get them.
Yeah.
So that for me, just streamlining all that stuff down would improve the game, certainly, yeah.
And a lot of times it was just that you had to get so many goddamn bananas to open up the gates that you spent a lot of time just wandering the stage going,
it did. I mean, look, Rare, I think it's fair to say, you know, given how prolific they were at the time, I feel like Rare were kind of stretched thin with their games in the N64 era. They certainly were some of the most ambitious games. And, you know, they seemed to be under this impression that the games needed to last a certain length of time and all this kind of stuff. And really, definitely, DK was probably the worst victim of, like, okay, you know, we've made these levels. How do we make them last longer? That. And Sunshine definitely it falls victim to that too. And, you know, I think you could benefit from cleaning up some of those things, as we discussed when we did the retroactive. So, I guess no point belaboring that.
I would say the one thing I'd want to point out about Sunshine is its ambition in a lot of ways wasn't like, how many ways can we make Mario move? I think they became fascinated with all the options that they gave you with Mario, that sometimes that was to its own detriment. They're like, Mario has a million different jumps. And so let's see how good you can get with the platforming. Oh, but the cameras are still reversed. So have fun with that.
Yeah, that's certainly, you know, the obvious kind of technical stuff that would improve, you know, again.
Yeah.
So, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, you know, with this question, in terms of there's plenty of games that can benefit, I guess. It's just, you know, could you find that rare situation where you could take something that really wasn't that good and then suddenly make it great rather than just kind of, you know, polishing up something that needed polishing.
I think that the biggest problem with the question is that we don't remember those games, because if they had like a really solid concept that was interesting, but they failed to execute it, other games probably did afterwards.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
I mean, it's got to be something that was so bad that it salted the earth behind it. But at the same time, you were like, oh, there's something. I mean, and I think something like Deadly P is in that territory where it's so bad. It's so.
Please don't call it that.
That's one of the official ways you can refer to that game. It's so bad that really it's kind of out there on its own. It's in this weird space that it lives in, and that ultimately, even Swery himself doesn't really go back to. I guess he's kind of toying with it now with that game he's trying to kickstart, but like, it's bizarre. I would say some of the Musou games, like, they felt like they weren't gonna make it, but they do, and they get there and they fix it. They now they do stuff with them, but yeah, I guess you're right. In general, if a game is that weird and does something really unique, but is also really bad, it's either really bad and everybody goes like, well, I'm not gonna be the one to try that. I'm staying away from this mess. Or it's bad, but still good enough in a way that someone else refines it.
They figure we can, you know, especially like when new hardware came along or whatever it might be. We could take that ball and run with it.
Right. Mm. Oh, I get what you were going for, but this is how you messed it up. Let me show you. And I think the one place that things have been dropped on is Congo-controlled pinball games. I think that's pinball strategy hybrid.
I think that's
the one place where nobody's picked up the ball and run with this.
It's true. But, you know, I still want to you the know, microphone still, as well. I want
that's
both.
True.
I want.
You gotta, I want to get the clip.
I want to do the flippers with the bongo, but I want to tell my troops what to do on the battlefield.
So really, the answer is just go find Yute Saito's entire back catalog, because he's been name dropped twice already. And just say everything in this back catalog is the answer to your question. If he was the producer, director, or lead creative, there's your answer.
I guess, you know, one thing that was very, you know, cause, I mean, we've already talked about, yeah, Saito's good. Molyneux is another name that gets kicked around in terms of, you know, the ideas are kind of, yeah, sound interesting, or he promises a lot, but then he struggles to follow through. Spore is an interesting one because that got so much buzz because people love the concept, but then the actual game, you know, failed to deliver. In short, not that I ever played it, but that certainly was the impression that I got.
It's pretty dull.
I don't know where, again, is that just a case of, no, actually, it's too ambitious for any era that you could do that well? And really, you know, but I suppose part of a remake could be to say, okay, let's, you know, not often this is not necessarily the case, but with remakes, because it's usually about, oh, bigger, better, badder, you know, kind of thing. But sometimes, actually, you know, maybe the best remake could be one that does trim the focus a little bit, but still tries to preserve the concept in spirit. And, you know, so that maybe that would be a candidate.
I would say it has the same problem as No Man's Sky, which is, yeah, you can randomly generate an infinite number of worlds and things, but ultimately that in and of itself doesn't give you that much. Like, yeah, it looks different than the other thing you did, but now it just looks different. It's not.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like the whole thing about no snowflakes being alike.
Well, yeah, but like, does it matter?
They are and they aren't. I mean, they are different, but they're trivially different.
Right. And so in the end, you don't end up with a better experience out of it. You just end up with a very, very slightly different one. David writes, "Hey, RFN crew, I'm wondering if you guys could play a game I made up. Let's call it the Nintendo franchise execution. The following list contains four pairs of Nintendo franchises. Imagine Nintendo hired you to kill one franchise from gaming history in each pair. Which one would you want to kill off? And why? Thanks and happy new year." Oh, it's an old email. So when he says kill off, I'm going to say that he means erase from the timeline. So this game never happened.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is significantly different from saying there will be.
He didn't say. I'm going to go with that.
There will be nothing further. It's right. One thing to say these, you know, you have to kind of wipe out the fun you had with those games is another matter.
So I want to lean on that because he drops some games in here that, like, I don't know what the future for WarioWare or Rhythm Heaven is. So, like, Rhythm Heaven, it may not be much to say that's the end of it because the person who was centrally figured in this game, I mean, may not want to do them anymore.
And WarioWare hasn't had a new game since DIY several years ago. So,
right. So, like, saying, like, I'm saying just straight up erased from the timeline and any consequence they had is also, therefore, lost with them. And so that is actually the first game, the first tuple.
The first dilemma, yeah.
Yeah, we'll call them the dilemmas. Rhythm Heaven or WarioWare.
Even though Rhythm Heaven's kind of like birthed out of WarioWare to some extent. So.
If you erase
WarioWare, do you erase that too?
I mean, that's... Let's just say for the sake of argument, in this case, we don't.
Well, I like both. If I like, spoiler alert, I like all of the properties that he's brought up. I guess that it wouldn't be a dilemma if that wasn't likely. But I'd have to kill WarioWare in this case. Rhythm Heaven is too dear to me.
Wow. I would go the opposite. I would go back in time and kill Rhythm Heaven's parents before...
People always say kill the parents, but the thing is, you think about Terminator, right? They didn't know who the dad was, right?
Right.
Right.
But you know,
with Time Cop here, but
No one is going with a time cop here.
Do know who the dad is, can't you just sterilize him or something? Do we have to kill him?
You don't have to sterilize him, just hook him up with somebody else.
Yeah, I just, you know, come on. Let's keep it bloodless.
just
Terminator, but Arnold is playing matchmaker between
it's a romantic comedy. Somebody pitched that in the 90s, believe me.
Just send a female T-1000 in who hides the fact she's a T-1000 and just like goes all in, like, no, whatever he wants, be that. And then he never meets Sarah Connor because he's good. He's taken care of. Timeline changed. Nobody had to die. And John Connor Sr. lived a good life. or whatever his name ends up being. I don't know.
Well, you know, the first one, there's a reason why they don't know the dad is who the dad is. It's a paradox.
So, the reason why I would kill off Rhythm Heaven is, I guess, as much as I liked Rhythm Heaven Fever, which is probably the entry that I really love the most, I think that losing WarioWare Twisted would be a bigger loss.
WarioWare Twisted is a really good game.
It's a great game, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no answer I'm happy with here.
No.
Yeah, there's no whoever loses, nobody wins.
AVP, you bring it in the Alien versus Predator tagline into this.
Yeah, in space, we can't scream. I'm tired.
So here's the thing for me on this one. And it's not easy. I don't like it, but in the end, the decision is pretty straightforward. WarioWare goes, and there's three reasons. One, I never have to see the fart power up on Wario ever again in Smash Brothers. Just saying, we're good on that one. But the other two are people. Ko Takeuchi never comes to my attention and never really reaches the height he is. And his stuff is amazing, and I'm glad to see his artwork occasionally. And he's just fantastic. And Sun Koo never becomes across my radar, and all of the fantastic music that he has created for these games. Like, those two together have created some of the most endearing moments of just gameplay that I've had in possibly anything. Just these pockets of really, really fantastically charming and enjoyable and just outright pleasant experiences of slapping spiders away from boxes of candy. And so without those two, WarioWare is great. WarioWare can be funny. WarioWare has some really interesting characters and gameplay ideas, and the micro game concept is super cool. But like, it ain't got nothing on those two when they combine to produce a mini game in Rhythm Heaven.
Yeah, the only thing I'll say if we was focusing on just going forward is that it seems like WarioWare has got more potential left in it, untapped potential, because they haven't done much for so long. I mean, Game and Wario had the gamer mode or whatever, which was kind of, but the fundamental, we kind of added that extra layer on top of it of the mother coming to get you, but fundamentally it was just WarioWare. But it's so ripe for experimentation, I feel like it's got more of a future to take away from it, if you know what I mean. But if we're talking about what I've already done with it, Rhythm Heaven wins.
I can see that, especially because Rhythm Heaven, I can see that it peters out eventually, but sometimes it only takes like a handful of new games that they add for me to go like, oh, these are fantastic. All right, so the next one up is Fire Emblem or Xenoblade. Jesus.
Fire Emblem. Please.
You want Fire Emblem dead.
Yes, absolutely. It's not even, there's no hesitation here.
You first. Greg, I need a minute. Do you have an idea?
I feel sort of similar. If I was going to go with just, we're talking about what experiences have been more sort of dear to me, Xenoblade wins, and so Fire Emblem dies. But, I mean, in terms of the future, Fire Emblem would seem to be poised to have quite a fruitful future, given that it's sort of fan popularity, you've got the Switch game and all that. I'm not sure where Xenoblade goes after two. So I kind of feel a little bit reticent to kill off what could be a more productive life ahead of it for the Fire Emblem series than for Xenoblade. But in the end, I'm going to say Fire Emblem has to go, sadly.
I'm going to go Xenoblade. And here's the reason, and this hurts. This one really hurts. I trust the team in Monolith Soft. They have absolutely earned the trust that I give them. From their from the creation of Xenoblade to their contributions to multiple Zelda games at this point, Xenoblade X creating an online game I give a shit about. with MMO mechanics I actually enjoy. Xenoblade 2 being the anime trope fest that I absolutely have started to fall in love with it for being so tropey sometimes. Even making Project Crosszone, which are fundamentally bad games, that I still bought a second one. That after I said, I can't play any more of this first game, oh, they put Kazuma Kiryu in it, fuck, alright, let's buy it.
I really don't think that you have to explain why you would give carte blanche to the creators of Disaster Day of Crisis.
Well, I actually, we all get it. No, because that's, let me pause, because the disaster game genre in Japan is a big thing, and they fundamentally made the best one of those on their first try. Versus people who that's all they do.
So basically what you're saying is you're okay with Xenoblade Go because I could just pick the Disaster series back up.
No.
And Disaster Day of Crisis X, and we're good.
Here's the thing. They've made so many good franchises. Like, you know, I absolutely adore the Baten Kaitos games, although they have some flaws.
Disaster Dusk of Crisis.
All their other Xeno games are really highly regarded. I have absolute faith that if Xenoblade never existed, they would have made something else fantastic. Because they have to. Because they're talented in ways that the people there are infinitely creative. They would have come up with something. I think if you take away Fire Emblem, and Fire Emblem never exists, I don't know that intelligence system exists right now.
Maybe, but if I'm focusing on looking forward, one of the... it's tasteless to put it this way, but one of the upsides of Fire Emblem's demise is maybe we get Advance Wars. Like, if you're going to play that kind of card, in terms of, oh, look at the developer's body of work and what else they could be doing.
I am looking at their body of work.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't disagree with the sentiment, but still, I'd bloody, if killing Fire Emblem is what it takes to get us an Advance Wars, I might just do it for that.
I'm not in love with where Fire Emblem has gone with the Fates games. I loved Awakening. Fates was too much. But
I really like Conquest. I mean, not so much the third path, but Conquest was right up my street. Kind of streamlined, you know, not about grinding or whatever, more about strategy.
But
story is another matter. But although I definitely liked the story better before you got to save everyone, you know, at least have some veneer of meaningful choice. But
I fell so hard for Shadows of Valentia. It's like, okay, they can do this. They can make this Fire Emblem thing work again. We're fine. All right. We got to move through it more quickly. Metroid or Zelda? Metroid. Next question.
This is tough because there was a time when I cared very much for Metroid, and I'm not sure I do anymore. There's so many Metroidvania games right now. What would the world look like if Metroid hadn't been released?
Oh, yeah, if we go in that, we'd just sort of wipe them all out.
Well, I was like earlier, like I was kind of imagining, like, oh, like what if Fire Emblem never existed? Does Shining Force just take the center stage and Camelot never, you know, like
no, it doesn't.
We're all enjoying Shining Force Heroes on mobile, and
the thing, Guillaume, they never stop making Shining Force games, but they sure stop making good ones.
Yeah, well, in the same vein, I guess I would kill Metroid. I don't really care with what's happening with the franchise now lately. And,
here's the biggest downside of Metroid never existing. You don't get to see Ego walking around with the bullwhip at E3.
That's
a huge loss. Because
I mean,
I don't know
certainly
how that
makes the probability much lower. Let's just put it that way. It depends how much of it is driven by, you know, his profession or his proclivities, I suppose.
I don't want to think about if Ego's
just turns up apropos of nothing with the whip.
I don't want to think about Ego's personal sadism.
I don't like the idea of killing either of these. I don't think it'd surprise anybody to say, but I'd probably have to go with Metroid. I think Zelda's future's brighter. It's the big thing. I mean, in terms of the treasured experiences, it's virtually impossible for me to say, well, which treasured experience would you rather get rid of, you know, Ocarina of Time or Super Metroid? Like, that's a hideous question to contemplate, and I'm not even going to try. So the tiebreaker is the future, and I think Zelda's future is prior.
All right, last one. Donkey Kong or Kirby? How much do you love the Big Ape?
It's a question for you first, James.
for me, it's pretty straightforward. If you get rid of Donkey Kong, you've completely nuked history.
Yeah. I mean, where do we start Donkey Kong in terms of, like, are we going to say where do you? Because I mean, it's tough because we're going to say like from. Like DKC onwards, but then like where does DK94 fall into that?
Like, if
you go back to arcade Donkey Kong, does it then, you know, subsume all the Mario games and destroy history itself?
Yeah, like do you unmake reality if you go after that one? I mean, that one's tough.
So I'd just say a series of
Popeye themed games.
That's right. Maybe
Popeye is the dominant force in interactive entertainment.
Maybe we're playing Popeye 36 right now. Who knows?
For me, again, I'm just going to sidestep all that stuff by saying let's look at the future. And Kirby is much more broad at this point. The Kirby franchise brings you more things. You get the core platformers, which are very good. Of late, like Robobot and Triple Deluxe and the forthcoming Star Allies and whatnot. But you get a lot more than that, don't you? You know, you get these weird experimental games that Kirby's in, you know, sometimes, or yeah, Mass Attack, I rather liked, Canvas Curse, I rather liked. You go further back to stuff like Dream Course and all. Just, you know, DK's narrow by comparison, so it kind of feels like you're killing less. Even though he's been in, I know he's been in, you know, Jungle Climber and, you know, a bunch of spin-off stuff too.
Bungos.
But Kirby's tough to compete with in just the amount of things that he's been put in.
Can I just get rid of Sonic instead?
No. Well, Sonic is forever, apparently.
That is the Fire Emblem Revelations path, isn't it? It's like, oh, this choice is quite tough. But wait, I don't actually have to make it. I can just kill Sonic instead.
What if I just kill Bubsy again? What if I just get to kill Bubsy a second time?
What if the Crawlies never came back? The Woolies.
The Woolies.
The Woolies, yeah.
Oh,
what if the Woolies never came back? This is tough. But yeah, I guess, okay, looking at the future, I guess, yeah, we lose less by killing Donkey Kong. And both series, though, I think, like, I didn't always like the Donkey Kong series, but Retro Studios have done, you know, a pair of really good platformers with them, and they've become kind of as delightful as a Kirby game. Like, it's
but much less forgiving.
Yeah, much less forgiving, but yeah, okay, kill off Donkey Kong.
See, I think this is why the whole, like, you have to erase it from history argument gets it more fun, because if you kill off Donkey Kong from history...
Well, you probably don't get Kirby if you kill off Donkey
Kong. Don't you kill Kirby, too?
Yeah. So, it kills off...
Does Kirby...
Well, WarioWare, it kills off Xenoblade.
Well, so here's the thing. HAL Studios still exists. Do they end up creating that game for, like, the MSX? Do we get Kirby on the MSX? Is Microsoft the dominant player in video games in Japan? Like, what happens if you kill Donkey Kong? I actually want to know now.
And Kirby games, Kirby games are so rooted in history that they're still screen by screen.
Can you believe we've done 558 episodes about Radar Scope? Jesus, so sick of talking about that game, as influential as it might have been.
Oh. Man, we'd be talking about the MSX6. Oh, God. All right, well, Greg, why don't you go ahead and read the last email?
Okay, so P. Patko writes, after doing such a hard reset on Zelda and 3D Mario, I would like to see Nintendo do the same with 2D Mario. Graphically, let's move away from sprite-based graphics. I want something that looks like the official Mario artwork by Yoichi Kotabe, like the peach letter scenes from Super Mario 3D Land, but fully animated like Wario Land Shake It. It wouldn't even have to be drastically different gameplay-wise. Hell, I'd love a reskin of Super Mario Bros. Deluxe with this kind of look. This would actually help to sell a subsequent Super Mario Maker sequel by including the new look as a fifth style choice. That, alongside a few more themes and building elements, such as slopes, and better sharing options, would be enough to justify a Super Mario Maker 2 purchase for me. What would you like from a new, but not quote-unquote new, Super Mario Brothers game? How could Nintendo shake up the series like they did with Odyssey and Breath of the Wild? Or should they even do that?
So can we call this Super New Mario Brothers? Just to delineate?
Yeah, well, you know, the new naming convention being like 12 years old
it's poison. Like,
is arguably up for retirement.
Because then how do you talk about a new Super Mario? Oh fuck! It's like they've actually poisoned the English language.
The problem is, you know, they have been each game, you know, that's appeared on the Nintendo platform. They are one of the biggest selling games on those platforms. So, you know, it is a brand unto itself, arguably. Although you have to say, with the really, really fast start that Odyssey has got off to, you know, at this point, the thing of like the 3D games couldn't sell as well as the 2D games. Like, I think the gap has closed. So some of that, of course, was they brought the 3D games closer to 2D style with like Super Mario 3D Land, which sold almost as well as new Super Mario Brothers 2 has sold on 3DS. But then Odyssey kind of, you know, blows that back up again and says, oh, we're going to go open and all that kind of stuff. And, that is on a very fast pace. So I guess maybe from that point of view, it's not sales-wise like as imperative for them to just deliver another one of those games because they're like the best-selling kind of Mario game. And maybe that frees them up to tinker with it a little bit, which, you know, wouldn't be past time, certainly.
I think Odyssey is now the best-selling Switch game. Like it sold in.
Yeah, it overtook the others, even though they also sold very well. You know, the Zelda sales are very good when you look at the history of that franchise. Splatoon 2 sales are very good, especially in Japan. But Mario Kart, of course, is a juggernaut globally. But it's superseded all of them in quite short order.
Yeah, I mean the tricky part for Odyssey, of course, is I haven't seen the breakdown, the regional breakdown, so I don't know what it looks like for Japan. But it's sold as much as both versions of Zelda.
Yeah, I mean it's in Japan it's a long way behind Splatoon 2 at this point because I think it's kind of million-ish and Splatoon 2 is 2 million, which is ridiculous.
Almost half of the worldwide sales of Splatoon 2 are in Japan.
Yeah, it's crazy how much that's dominant in Japan. So yeah, that's going to make any game look like a little bit weak by comparison. But it's just the way the dynamics out there.
So if you've not, I was going to say if you've not seen Kotabe's art, you have. But like, a lot of his art is now kind of in game after all. Like I know he did a bunch of art that's in like the Mario Party games recently. He did a little bit of art. For some other stuff, but he actually left Nintendo for a while. He was doing like lectures and stuff, but he came back relatively recently to do some work. So that actually would be a return to sprites because the new Super Mario Brothers games were in fact renowned because they moved away from sprites. They moved to 3D models.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, when you go to the original New Super Mario Brothers on DS, you had a mixture of sprites, but they were either pre-rendered kind of style,
right,
and then polygonal characters that were meant to look like those kind of pre-rendered things. So it was a little bit of a kind of hybrid look, but it was all meant to look like the sort of character art that became dominant for the Mario series sort of in the N64 era, where these sort of these renders were supposed to signify that yes, we're with it technologically.
They've been very, to that point, they've been very firm about keeping Mario on model since then.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you look at Mario before that, like, he's all over the place.
No, he's when it was actually drawn, when he was illustrated for various different games, he often came out quite different until they started to standardize things, I feel like, with some of Kotabe's art. You know, as Mario got to be in more and more things like Mario Kart and so on, in the Super Nintendo era. But then, you know, that gave way to the, you know, especially because of the success of DKC, with its renders, you know, really, you know, was a triumph of marketing as much as it was a triumph of the game. You know, that spilled over into, you know, the Mario stuff and all. I mean, again, I mean, you know, Mario 64, obviously the polygonal model, it does not look, bear much resemblance to that render on the box, but it was all about it being three-dimensional. Yeah, you know, that was the whole pitch, and then that just became the template for him in general, whatever he was in.
Yeah, they I'm looking at some art comparisons of Miyamoto's sketches and Kotabe's. You can see that ultimately, like, for a lot of characters except for Mario, Kotabe is the one who won out in the design. Like, his design ends up looking closer to what On Model is for these characters. Because he, you know, he's a very, very, very experienced artist in a way that even Mr. Miyamoto isn't. Because he was an animator. Like, that was his professional career before he came to Nintendo. He wasn't relatively young at that point. He was already mature in his career. He's experienced, and he really cleaned up a lot of these designs. And yeah, seeing those animated kind of in a Wario Land shake, it would be really cool.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Wario Land Shake, it remains a good-looking game, even though obviously that was a standard definition game, a 4x3 game,
yes.
for some reason, back on Wii. But, you know, was it Studio IG or whatever?
Yep.
They were the company that they partner with on that. But, yeah, I mean, the thought of a Mario game looking something like that, but, you know, interpreted through the lens of the classic Mario art that we associate with Kotabe, I think it'd be wonderful. I mean, it really would. I mean, I guess, you know, I don't strongly dislike the new Super Mario Brothers art style, you know, because it is very much like the sort of the standard look for him across a number of different games and whatnot, not just the side-scrollers, but it's no doubt it's pretty kind of tired at this point. It's been used a lot, and it's kind of, you know, the technology that's available to them now has gone so far beyond, you know, especially the DS game, where the sort of aesthetic was born, but, you know, even well beyond, you know, Wii, where it was kind of cemented in the Wii game. I just feel there's so much more you could do, and it also applies to the game design too. You know, I feel like it has evolved a little bit, and I think, you know, look at, for me, New Super Mario Brothers U, you know, where it gets sort of walks up to, you know, Mario World more, and all that, like, it's an excellent game. I think it's just kind of, so the impact of it is kind of blunted by the fact that they were so kind of iterative up to that point.
I mean, they had released one that year.
Well, yes, especially given that, with two coming out on 3DS in that very hurried fashion, which, you know, I guess we don't expect to see something like that with Switch because it's done well. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you wonder whether there was like a new Super Mario Brothers protocol that would have been activated if things didn't go well with Odyssey and
siren goes off
with the system in general. But, you know, that lever has not had to be pulled because Odyssey's doing great, system's doing great. You know, no need to worry there. So maybe it will be a while before we see some of this. So kind of, as I was kind of touched on with the prediction a little bit, in some ways I kind of expect to see Mario Maker come back in some fashion, maybe before we see a new side scroller, you know, because I think it could be a good vehicle for their online kind of you know, efforts and all that kind of thing, rather than the other way around. You know, it has been a while now. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they were pretty consistent, you know, 2006, 2009, and then, you know, the double whammy in 2012. So to get to this point is kind of surprising. Sorry, the double whammy 2013, wasn't it? It was 2012.
It
was 2012, but it was just very late 2012 by the time. Yeah,
right, because it came out with the launch of Wii U, but the first one came out in the summer.
Yeah. So two was in. So the point is, it was a 3-year kind of thing at that point. You know,
and then it was 6 months apart. We got two of the damn things.
Yeah, two of them. But now it's been several years.
I mean, to be fair though, they didn't call it new, but Super Mario Run. Very cool.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And that, of course, maintains the aesthetic very strongly.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
The highest resolution Mario rendered to date.
Yeah, but very much that style just back again. So I'm not sure how much we could get our hopes up here, but the possibilities are, I think, really exciting. Maybe, like I said, the fact that Odyssey has been a huge success will just make them, you can afford to be a bit less conservative with a side scroller and say, well, we've already got a mega seller with Mario, that we didn't just kind of play safe with. So maybe we could go that route again, or it's just a case of, well, we want something in our lineup that's very dependable in terms of what it can bring in. So we'll just have that as part of the portfolio again, even if, because I mean, the most likely thing to get dropped is the name. Yeah, the new name. When it's been 6 years, when it's been 6 years and you haven't used the new prefix, I think that needs to go. But it could still be the pre-rendered style look and all that kind of stuff, and the 3-star coins and all that. You know, there's so many things that have remained constant that I personally think aesthetically, yes, I would love to see it refreshed, and that alone would be a big kind of boost. But I want to see it structurally refreshed too.
I don't really have any kind of specific idea about the look or what I want to see in a 2D new 2D Mario game, but maybe just in general, handing it out to other studios, like we've met. Well, Wario Land, Shake It was brought up. Why not give it to Good Feel or Retro Studios? Proved that they could make a good 2D platformer with two Donkey Kong games. Like, why not give Mario to them? Like, let's see finally Mario in a minecart.
Some
other team.
That's worse than anything you said in the predictions.
Some other team that
high
we're not
a bar
really...
you just leapt over.
Yeah, it's interesting whether because it is something that you feel like is really difficult to kind of get out of their hands, probably. At the same time, I don't see why it necessarily should be. Because it's not as if they're not going to be working on Mario games of some type. Clearly, there are the internal Nintendo developers are always going to be bringing us some kind of core Mario experience. But as we see with Odyssey and 3D Land, 3D World, this kind of, it doesn't have to be a side scroller to be that. And then you could give the side scroller to somebody else you trust. And maybe it would kind of get freshened up along with that. But they are, given that it's such a big earner, you kind of feel like just inertia and conservatism would win out there. And it's like, well, we kind of have to do it, they could farm out Mario Kart hypothetically, and it would probably be good, but they won't do that because it's like, it's such a huge seller that it'd probably be some internal feeling of like, oh, we don't want to kill the golden goose by something unexpected happening. It's not quite as within our control.
And here's the other thing to think about in that standpoint. For Good Feel, probably not so much. Good Feel's like, they basically provide Good Feel with their work. But like, if Nintendo came to you to make a Mario Kart game, you're gonna say, "I want scale. I want a cut," because it's gonna sell 6.5 million units. You're gonna want a goddamn cut, and Nintendo's not gonna want to do that.
That's what I say. Because they're such big earners, that's why not just in terms of you don't want anything to go awry in terms of scheduling or, quality, whatever it might be. That's harder to manage when it's somewhat external, though obviously not impossible. They do it all the time. But also, the actual contractual component to it gets more complicated.
What I would love to see, I'm thinking about this a little bit, is maybe, something that gives a little bit more freedom to experiment in terms of what the levels are. There's the 2D platformer genre back in the early 90s was really diverse. You know, we don't really think about it because there were so many clones of, you know, there were Sonic games, there were Sonic clones, there were Mario games, there were Mario clones. There were things happening on like the TG16 that are unique and kind of cool. There were things happening on the Super Nintendo that weren't clones of anything, that are just like these random, really good platformers that did their own stuff, that weren't just like get from A to B and clear the stage. And in fact, even Mario on the Game Boy space, where there were hidden exits and things, was doing things that are different. You know, making a Mario game that just doesn't feel like a Mario game, that's trying to do different stuff in the platforming space. But I think it needs to be very visually distinct. I think you could say that using the art style of Kotabe would be one way of doing it, although ultimately you're still going to be pretty close to on model.
But I guess it's just maybe the fact that if he was trying to go for a hand-drawn look.
Right, look would still be there. One thing that I think, Greg, you nailed, and I think we may have also missed another way of looking at it, is if they release a 2D Mario game before they release Mario Maker, they're going to have to justify putting it or not including it in Mario Maker.
If it did have a substantially different style, right? Yeah, especially.
So putting out Mario Maker first removes that need, and if they can adapt it to Mario Maker, well, we can always just sell it as DLC, which is of course their new objective.
Yeah, they've said, you know, in the latest earnings, sort of briefies and all that kind of stuff, that this is something they want to hit harder, even though they've already kind of stepped it up significantly. I feel like at the beginning of this Switch, you know, hardware cycle, the results are in today, and they are, we can do more of this.
Yeah, I will say that to give credit to W. Matthew, who was in my Twitch chat earlier, he was saying that one of the things about Mario Maker that he liked was that people were doing stuff with Mario Maker that felt like out of other franchises, with like keys to doors and stuff, and like progression blocks, and having to explore the stage. And you can do all that stuff in a Mario format. They just don't tend to.
Yeah, like I say, it's become very, you know, to be fair, New Super Mario Bros. U, you know, it gets closer to Mario World in terms of you could skip worlds by finding secret exits, you know, to stages that, you know, that and therefore you have a kind of more substantially different experience getting to, you know, the final boss and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, that got closer to, you know, Mario World being my first Mario game, is kind of remains my kind of conceptual kind of touchstone for that series, so it was nice to get closer to that. But like I said, it still had a lot of the kind of conventions of the New Super Mario Brothers kind of anchoring it down a bit into, you know, like I said, with the always having 3 star coins, and, you know, like, right, you can't take Yoshi with you out of a level, he's just for that level, for instance, things like that. So it's funny, it still felt like it was not quite all the way up to Mario World, where of course, you know, Mario World is more than a quarter of a century old. You might argue, you know, that you could go beyond it in 2D. Obviously, you know, they've kind of gone beyond it in 3D in certain ways, but, you know, that a more progressive 2D game, which I think is kind of, you know, what you're talking about, is possible. You know, but I guess the problem is, you know, is there a need for a more progressive 2D game when you have the 3D games? I think that's always been the thing that's kind of held it back, and that the 2D games have been seen more as nostalgia products.
Yeah, but I think they can be more than that. And I think now that they've made their bread and they can continue to sell Mario Maker as the nostalgia product, they can say, okay.
Yeah, that's true. That's the other, kind of triangulate a little bit, in terms of you have the 3D games, you have Mario Maker, maybe that opens up a space for something that isn't New Super Mario Brothers to be different.
Yeah, you could keep making Mario Maker, and this is that is the ultimate nostalgia project. And you could even have like, hey, Miyamoto made 3 Mario Maker stages. They're going live on the service next week. There they are. But then you can say, here is this 2D Mario franchise that we have just said, let's go back and make a game that feels like a different era of 2D platforming. Let's make Mario into a bonk game. Screw it. Let's see how this goes. Like anything. It just, where you're not built on nostalgia. Basically, Nintendo has a lot of fucking Mario.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like I said, that I do feel like this, for all the use of the character and all that, like this idea of like actually, you know, aesthetically kind of channeling, you know, some of a classic look and all this kind of, he's untapped, you know, for as much as they've used him. Like, it's kind of an obvious area that's just untapped. In terms of, you know, you could imagine in a lot of cases, if it was another company, you know, you would have just had, like, you know, Super Mario Brothers, the HD remake, where, you know, as P-Pack says with the Super Mario Brothers Deluxe example, it's just like, okay, it's just that game, but here it is with, you know, Wonder Boy, Dragon's Trap.
Right.
Hmm. Like, that kind of treatment for the original Super Mario Brothers. You know, I mean, it's pretty obvious sort of stuff, but they haven't done it. You know, and I don't know whether it's because they have these sort of very, you know, rigid kind of guidelines for managing his image or whatever. But, you know, I hope there's a way to get those relaxed, because there is, for as much as they've used him, still untapped potential in that, to my mind.
Fair enough. All right, well, that's going to do it for us this week. Remember, next week we are doing our WiiWare Retroactive round 1 and 2 on Yumi and the Cubes and Bonsai Barber. I said we'd announce the next one, which would be just one game this episode. I don't have it yet. We'll have it in the article for this episode. So you can get that there, or you can get it from our Twitter, RFN podcast. Right? Yes. But I don't know why I had to think about that. But you can send us your emails, questions, comments to RFN at NintendoWorldReport.com. Again, join us next week for our first rounds of Retroactives. You can post comments in the TalkBack threads. Greg, do we have some end music for this week?
Of course, yeah. This week's end music is Fly Eagles Fly, naturally. Not really. We're a few days away from Bayonetta coming back. We've got Bayonetta and Bayonetta 2. But especially nice, I feel like, for Bayonetta 2, because it's getting to be on an install base that's already bigger than what's on Switch than it was on Wii U. And it's a terrific game. I really, really do like the sequel. I thought I'd go with the soundtrack, something from the soundtrack, something a little bit more off the beaten track, you know, that you wouldn't have heard, like in Smash Brothers, if you bought that DLC or whatever. So this is it's platinum with the soundtracks and everything else, for that matter. They are the masters of the grandiose. If you want something that seems humongous, preposterously big, they are great at doing it, and this song kind of evokes the sort of build up, the anticipation to one of those crazy platinum climaxes, and it's called To the Top from Bayonetta 2. I hope everybody enjoys it.
Excellent. All right, let's go do it. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.